Welcome again, everybody. Welcome again. Someone reminded me the other day, said the last few times you've talked, you haven't introduced yourself. So I should probably get in a better habit of doing that. It's mostly a combination of nervousness and excitement that I don't. It's not an assumption that everyone knows. I just forget. So my name is Carrie Peterson, and this is the first talk I've given this year. It was at the Refuges and Precepts ceremony with Tim and Tweri the first January of the year. And as many of you know by now, this year we're diving into the Four Noble Truths. So maybe some people have already begun that dive. But it's as though last year when we were doing the paramis, or the kind of wholesome and onward leading qualities of the heart and mind, we were gathering our resources, storing up our reserves, brightening our hearts and minds. And this year we're diving in. So 2025 seems like it may be a good year for that, but we'll see. So as most of you are probably aware, the Four Noble Truths are the heart. I really talked about them at Under 40 the other night as the heart of the matter. It's really the central teaching out of which a lot of other teachings spring and refer back to and interweave. And more than anything, this first truth, and particularly the way that we're approaching it, really invites us to go beyond a cursory kind of glance or an intellectual kind of I kind of get it, sort of sense. But it really invites us to get very close and direct and immediate with our experience of suffering. And why on earth would we want to do that? That's a good first question. When a lot of our instincts and impulses and good sense tells us to go in the complete opposite direction, right? Have you noticed that? So why would we want to do this? I think it's a really valid first question. And I've been reflecting on it, and just imagine for a moment, what would your life look like, be like, if you had never had an experience of distress, disappointment, frustration, agitation, physical discomfort, dis-ease? What would it be like? It's hard to even imagine it, right? It's hard to even fathom what it would be like. And in other traditions, they talk about the realms in which there is no suffering as kind of pure lands or heavenly realms where there is no suffering. But for the purposes of awakening, this realm, this human realm, is said to be ideal because we have a fair bit of suffering, and we also have mindful awareness. We have this knowing capacity, and we have the ability to reflect and understand our experience, and in doing that, potentially transform it, right? Potentially relate to it differently so that it no longer becomes suffering. So I'll kind of explain a little bit more as we go. But the Pali word for this, what we're translating as suffering, the Pali is really so much better. So Pali is the language in which the Buddha's teachings were initially written down in about 500 years after he lived. And the Pali word for dukkha, or this territory of the First Noble Truth, the Pali word for suffering is dukkha. And it's a wonderful word. It's got some punch to it, you say dukkha. So when I lived at a retreat center, it was the first time I had really, this was like more than 20 years ago now, but it's the first time I encountered people using dukkha in like a conversational way. So when we would burn the rice, it would be dukkha. You know, when it was, you know, when somebody would break a doorknob or, you know, complain about something, light bulb, dukkha, right? When we'd run out of something or the meal was late or we'd get a really critical piece of feedback, dukkha. So it was like an alternative to swearing. but it has a kind of ugh quality to it. Ugh. And that is what this noble truth is inviting us into. It's not asking us to believe something, to memorize something, to fit our life, squeeze our life, our human experience, our complex human experience into a list or into a predetermined shape. It's actually inviting us into a more complete experience of being human. So that's a profound invitation. And suffering or dukkha is translated a lot of different ways. So it's translated as suffering. Sometimes it's translated as dis-ease. Speaking of dukkha, I managed to forget my glasses tonight. So those online especially will be seeing a lot of squinting. And I can't promise that I'm getting this exactly right. But in this, the Buddha's first real formal teaching is called the Discourse on Setting the Wheel of the Dharma in Motion. Right? So with this exposition or description of these truths, it's like it set a wheel turning that is still turning. This kind of radical sort of alternate perspective on what it means to be human. And so this is just part of that teaching that speaks to the specific nature of dukkha. So suffering can be general, it can be collective, it can be universal in a lot of ways, but it also has this very specific quality that we're asked to kind of touch more deeply. So this is from the discourse. Bhikkhus, there is a noble truth with regard to suffering. Birth is difficult. Aging is hard. Dying is painful. Sorrow, grieving, pain, anguish, and despair are all painful. Being stuck with what you don't like is stressful. Being separated from what you do like is stressful. Not getting what you want is stressful. In brief, the five aggregates that are affected by clinging bring no satisfaction. There is this noble truth with regard to suffering. In this way, practitioners, vision, insight, wisdom, knowing, and light arose in me about things not heard before. This noble truth with regard to suffering is to be thoroughly understood. In this way, practitioners, vision, insight, wisdom, knowing, and light arose in me about things not heard before. This noble truth with regard to suffering has been thoroughly understood. In this way, practitioners, vision, insight, wisdom, knowing, and light arose in me about things not heard before. So this translation is from Ajahn Suchito. And as you can hear in the first part, there are all of these translations of suffering, painful, stressful, separated from what you do like, not getting what you want, being together with what you don't like. All of these things are specific forms of dukkha. And the commonality there is they hurt. Yeah. So in short, if we're getting to the first part of this noble truth, it's that it hurts. This part of being human hurts. And so we can try every which way to kind of skirt around that or distract ourselves from that or kind of take the edge off of that. But there's this kind of sober, direct reality, which is that this hurts. This human realm hurts. I know the invitation of the Four Noble Truths is not that this is the end of the story. This is the beginning of the story. Right? We can't, as much as we would like to get right to the end, this is the beginning of the story. And the Buddha also said, there is a kind of suffering that leads to more suffering. So when we resist this fundamental aspect of suffering, it has a way of compounding and compiling that suffering. So our resistance to this kind of suffering leads to more suffering. So suffering can either lead to more suffering or it can lead to search. So for many of us, suffering is what brings us to the path in the first place. I know really early on when I was assisting Rodney, so Rodney Smith, our founding teacher, assist him on beginning classes, and would sit up at the front and watch all of these people come in and go week after week after week, year after year after year, come in, go. And I asked once, how is it, or we were just reflecting together, how is it that so many people come and go? And what is it, how come some people stay? I guess that was my question. Why so many people come through and leave? And, you know, the majority come through and leave. Why do some people stay? And he said, probably one of two things. He said, first, I have no idea, but maybe one of two things. One is suffering. Yeah, suffering. And the very human need to seek some understanding around that experience of suffering, some alleviation of that. And he said, the other reason is curiosity. Some people have just a kind of burning curiosity to know and understand, what is this life? What is this experience? And I always thought that was interesting. I was like, who are these people who are motivated by curiosity? I was intensely motivated by suffering. I thought, how nice just to be kind of curious about how it all works. But when I reflect back on my path, in the first 10 years of my life were mostly shock at how much suffering existed, and just trying to even grasp the immensity of that around me. So I was listening to a wonderful, and then watching a wonderful conversation with John Batiste, the musician, and Tim Ferriss, a podcaster, meditator, writer. And John Batiste was saying that for the first 10 years of his life, he was almost mute, almost didn't speak at all. Because it was almost as though his being was just trying to grasp or absorb everything that was going on around him, and couldn't actually make sense or formulate or even develop any kind of response to that. It was completely absorbing. And so it was only later that in his teenage years, did he really start kind of being able to engage in a full way? And that was certainly true in my early years as well. So there was a great kind of receptivity and porousness to the experience of the people around me. And sometimes that experience was wonderful and loving and beautiful and spacious, and other times it was immensely painful and suffering, a lot of suffering. So for those of us who have, and I think we all have this to some degree, we may have a special motivation to discover what is this experience of suffering. And we're not so much looking for a why around it. So we can explain a lot of whys. We can put a lot of or a lot of reasons or explanations, personal, physiological, familial, cultural, for our experience of suffering. But the path that the Buddha is pointing to is a very direct moving towards the specific way that it shows up in this very life, in the here and now. So the second part of the passage that I read described the three insights into this noble truth. So a lot of what we're doing this year is exploring not just the Four Noble Truths, but the insights into each truth. And this part isn't always highlighted as much as the Four Noble Truths. And this is a really, really important, and I really appreciate the way Ajahn Suchito talks about this, because you can tell by this language, in this way, with regard to suffering, vision, insight, wisdom, knowing, and light arose in me about things not heard before. Right. So this points to understanding not in the usual way that we understand things. This points more to towards the way that insight arises in response to our own experience. It doesn't come from churning about it or worrying about it or, you know, trying to fit all the pieces together in a logical, rational way. Dukkha is not rational. Have you noticed that? It is not a rational process. The times at which I have felt the most dissatisfied, disappointed, upset, distressed, they don't have a particularly rational cause. So it's describing the way that we enter a process with our practice when we're engaging, especially with the First Noble Truth. So one of my teachers, Willa Tanya, a wonderful teacher, was a practicing nun in the Thai forest tradition for many years, but now lives in New Zealand. Still practices in that tradition, just is no longer ordained. But she'll just say over and over again, this teaching is the invitation to enter a process. Right? It is not a checklist. It is an invitation to enter an organic process because we are organic, dynamic organisms. Right? So it's an invitation to enter a process. The first part of this process is the recognition that there is dukkha. It exists. It's not the whole of the story. It's not a life sentence. It exists. So when I think back to my first, like, very early plunge, nonverbal plunge into suffering, and maybe what would have been helpful, and with full acknowledgement that everyone around me gave me all the care that they possibly could, and I was very, very well cared for in a lot of ways, but this simple acknowledgement that there is suffering. So part of what was so painful, I think, and throughout my life, and for many people, I think, is this dissonance between what we experience on the inside and what is acknowledged on the outside. Right? So there's a real gap, there often has been, a real gap between the depth of what's happening on the inside and what is talked about on the outside. So I remember watching with amazement as the people around me would go from what seemed like pretty intense struggle and suffering to like making a business call and sounding like, oh, everything's great in the world, or going into this like peppy, it's all great, it's all fine persona. And I could never do that. So my beloved grandfather, I have worked a lot in elder care and helped many of my family members in that journey as they were dying. My beloved 98-year-old grandfather, as he was dying, and I said, I was trying to position him. I was just saying, well, Grandpa, I'm just worried that if you're too far over here, you know, you might fall or something like that. He said, Carrie, I think you were born worried, right? It's like, I think you were born without the capacity to like compartmentalize or lighten up or just get over it or look on the bright side. So for better or worse, this being has been quite motivated to enter a process of understanding this. So that acknowledgement, when I first heard it in Buddhism, was a huge relief. Yeah? Ah, okay. This is not some, this took a while to really grasp, but this is not some character flaw of mine. This is not some personal deficiency. This is the nature of this human experience. So, and it is, the invitation is that it is to be understood. So not intellectually, but some teachers flip that around. This is to be stood under. Yeah? This is to be stood under, to be fully felt, embraced, acknowledged. And without doing that, our practice can't deepen. So one of the titles, I thought of many titles for this talk, but one of them is No Dukkha, No Path. Right? Try to think about what your life would look like without dukkha. There would be no need for a path. So no dukkha, no path. Also, no dukkha, no compassion. No dukkha, no compassion. So one of the most satisfying parts, and I'm skipping ahead already, but one of the most satisfying parts of this point in my practice life and being able to really offer more fully and meet people who are really sincerely entering this process of moving towards their dukkha is that it feels as though the ways in which I have suffered can be useful for other people. Not in a cliched way, but because what you recognize in your own mind, you will recognize in other people's minds. What you recognize in other people's minds, you will recognize in your own minds. So the work you do on yourself will allow you to be more available to the people around you. Every move you make towards your own dukkha will help you in being with other people's dukkha. So suffering is very specific. It is very textured. It's felt. It's moment by moment. It is also collective. It is also shared. So it has both of those aspects. But without dukkha, there is no compassion. Dukkha is the open heart's response, or compassion is the open heart's response to dukkha. But we have to be able to bear it. We have to be able to bear it in a way that's helpful. So this entering into a process, as probably everyone is aware, takes time, and it is not a straight line. Right? It is a messy, non-straightforward experience. So the insights with each truth are, Philip Moffat explains them as, the first insight with each truth has to do with reflecting. So this is kind of just a surface level reflecting, just a recognition that yes, there is suffering. The second insight goes into a direct experience of it. So suffering is to be understood, gives us a direction. But the direct experience of it is that it feels like this. suffering in this moment feels like this. So we enter it directly. And the last insight is when it's been integrated, it's been understood, it's been realized, and like it's been digested. So that third insight, we really know, okay, this has been digested. I don't feel suffering in that particular area any longer, right? It doesn't arise in the same way. So we move from kind of a reflecting to a directly experiencing or standing under to an integration or a complete digesting or realizing. And the way that we do that is by this kind of insight or a deeper way of approaching and understanding, like Ajahn Suchito was paraphrasing the Buddha there, not paraphrasing, translating the Buddha there. So when we are willing to kind of stand under, to come close to the direct experience of dukkha, that gives us a different perspective on it, a more penetrating view or insight into it. So I'll just say a word about that because I think it's helpful, and many of you probably already practice in this way. But Philip Moffat and many Buddhist teachers refer to this felt sense quality as a way of kind of standing under or understanding the nature of dukkha in our own experience. So the felt sense, I was pointing to it a little bit with the receptivity in the guided practice, but the felt sense comes from actually a psychologist named Eugene Gendlin, who some research and practice at the University of Chicago, but he realized in his course of working with people in the therapeutic modalities that people who had seen him for years and years, who had just talked about their experience of suffering, had talked about it in a certain way for a long time, he noticed they weren't improving by just talking about it. And he started to experiment with inviting people into what he called a felt sense. So that's entering a kind of open, receptive, direct texture of the nature of that experience. Right? So when I feel deeply disappointed with someone, somebody lets me down, I expected that they would be there in a certain way and they're not. I can go through mentally all of the ways that justify my experience of that. You know, how they're always this way, or why can't they be a little bit different, or if I were a little bit different, or maybe I'll try this in the future. But the reality of dukkha in that moment is, kind of a sinking sort of disappointment, kind of it just feels like a sinking. So we'll all experience that a little bit differently. When we feel frustrated, when we feel let down, when we feel any kind of mental suffering, it will have a felt sense to it. So bringing mindful awareness to that felt sense, it doesn't mean that we stare at it, doesn't mean that we recognize it in a kind of intellectual way, but we're really invited to enter it. So this is what changes our relationship with suffering. I'm sure Tim mentioned this, but it's important to differentiate that there is the physical aspect of pain. So our bodies, just by virtue of being human, experience, you know, aging, sickness, dying, all that. There's a physical component to that. That doesn't change whether we're an ordinary worldling, as the Buddha said, or whether we're a fully awakened being. That raw experience of pain doesn't change. What gets transformed is that mental experience of suffering or dukkha, that resistance to that experience. So that mental experience also has a texture or a physical component. You know, having somebody insult me on its face is different than having someone punch me in the stomach, right? From what I understand, and I'm in no way a scientist, but the regions in the brain that register physical pain are very close to the regions that register mental suffering like being rejected, being left out, being disappointed, being misunderstood. We register those in similar overlapping regions in the brain, so they are felt physically. We can feel them. The advantage to doing that, even though it can be acutely uncomfortable, is that in that turning, we come out of our mental proliferation around suffering, and we enter something that is in the process of dynamic change. Right? It's shifting, it's moving, it's changing. And I think it allows us to experience in an immediate, direct, human way, compassion. Yeah. We feel, oh, when we really experience, oh, this hurts. When someone is talking to us and we can really feel, oh, that hurts for them. That hurts. Compassion arises. So this is kind of penetrating. It's talked about that this noble truth can be penetrated. We can get to the center of it, not by cracking it apart, not by intellectually dissecting it, but by entering this process. So it takes a fair bit of trust because it goes against a lot of our instincts, a lot of our impulses. But there is the invitation to just stay, be a little bit longer than we would want to, or that we're interested in. So I just want to read a little bit from this, in speaking to this compassion piece. This is a beautiful reflection from the Zen tradition. This is by Joan Sutherland Roshi. It's a translation of a Zen sutra that speaks to the intersection of wisdom and compassion as they're kind of personified in two characters, Vimalakirti and Manjushri. So I won't go into their whole dance, and even though it's beautiful, but there's this reflection from one of the characters, Vimalakirti, who's sick, kind of sick physically, but also sick mentally, like heart sick for the world, right? So it's their dialogue, but it's also Vimalakirti's reflection on, like, kind of what does it mean to have dukkha? And it's saying that, or he's saying that, he repeats this line, "I am sick because the world is sick." So I hurt because the world hurts.
Yeah.
I am distressed because the world is distressed, because I am a part of the world. So the real agony and tragedy of our suffering is when it collapses us into an isolated, separate entity who feels cut off from the rest of humanity and the world. That is the tragedy of suffering. But from my own life, the benefit or the promise of turning towards our suffering in this way is that it actually opens us out into a greater shared experience of being human, a real sense that we are in this together, and that oftentimes we are with suffering where there isn't anything we can do about it. Yeah. Where when I've been with people who are dying, oftentimes when we're parenting or caregiving, or often people who are struggling, there is nothing you can do to alleviate that, but be there, right? But just be there. So, sometimes it's easier to get a sense of this when we think about it with other people. But for ourselves, sometimes that's all the path is asking us to do, is just be there with what's happening. So you don't need to enter a Buddhist studies course. Yeah. You don't need to have the lists memorized. You don't need to kind of get a PhD in world religions. There just has to be this simple willingness to enter this process. And really that is primary. And we find a lot of companions and friends and sangha along the way, who are willing to accompany us in that journey. Okay. So this is Joan Sutherland describing Vimalakirti's reflection. I am sick because the whole world is sick. This is the purest formulation of Vimalakirti's absolute, unquestioned, unmitigated, unbuffered, uncompromised allegiance to this world. I am the world, and the world is me. We have one condition. When the world's heart is breaking, my heart breaks. When the morning star rises, I rise with it. I am the sorrow of the world and its joy, and we share the same fate. To love is to love the world, and to hate is to hate the world. The world's healing is my healing, in which I have an infinitesimal and, is that it? Infinitesimal. Infinitesimal and essential part. It is that simple, that naked and open, that settled in the deepest places, the underground delta where the river of my heart mind meets the sea of the world. This is my, here is my condition, out of which everything else flows. Here is my condition, out of which everything else flows. When I can touch this without twitching, abide here without fleeing, what naturally flows into me from the sea of the world is the intention toward awakening. Because my awakening is the world's awakening. I am waking because the whole world is waking. Okay. So maybe we can just sit quietly with that for a moment, a few moments. So I'd love for you to have a chance to reflect on this together. I know you have been, some people have been all month, but maybe before I invite a smaller, just a few minutes of a smaller group format, maybe we can just see if there are any reflections. I'd love it if there are any reflections or comments or just questions in the room. I always like to encourage people, you don't have to have something fully formulated. You don't have to have anything profound or rehearsed to add. Especially with this reflection, which can feel kind of raw, it's, I think, often fine just to plunge in. And being without glasses, I am going to have to trust you. I think Monica, do you have a hand? Okay, hi, Monica.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, nice to see you.
Yeah, nice to see you, and thank you for the talk. I'm definitely one of those who showed up and stuck around because of suffering. I was really struck by you talking about the felt body experience of mental suffering. And I've come to realize that I will do almost anything to avoid that. And I'm thinking that I want to avoid other things, like I want to avoid work, I want to avoid, you know, confronting this or that person, etc. But, you know, it's really not as complex as I'm making it out to be, that I want to avoid. I just don't want my body to experience what it's going to be like.
That's exactly it. Yeah, your body mind, so they're connected, right? But not, yeah, not wanting to, right, that's exactly right.
I just wanted to see whether that felt true, because, you know, it's a new realization. I've always thought that, oh, I have this like really complex mental life, and, you know, like I have 10 logical arguments about why I'm avoiding this, but it's really like me trying to avoid my body to feel this, and it's very maladaptive. But, you know, I hope that in the next, the rest of the year, we can talk about how to get the courage or the fortitude to face this, because that's still a question that's
Well, first, that feels like a really helpful insight, Monica. It's like yes, this is right, this is kind of the nature of why I'm avoiding that. And of course I would, you know, that's also our kind of, our instincts move us in that direction. How can I avoid this? And so I think we have to move gently and carefully, but it is helpful to see that, oh, when I'm avoiding that person like the plague, or when I'm avoiding that situation, there's something, it's not really about the person or the situation. It's about what's happening here. So that is a really crucial insight. Otherwise we can, you know, we wall ourselves off from a lot of life, thinking that it's out there. So if we can, you know, recognize that, oh, I'm avoiding some experience that's uncomfortable in here, and be compassionate about that, right? That's not easy. It's easy to talk about, but it's not easy. So it's more like, how can I enter that with all of my resources, with all of my mindful awareness? How can I just take one small step moving in that direction? You know, and sometimes it feels like, you know, walking into water that's too cold or something. Often we're just dropped into that unpleasantness. But if we're working with it gradually like that as a practice, we can just take one small step in that direction and then just see, okay, how is it now? How is it now? Bringing awareness to this. How is it? And it's a kind awareness, right? So it's not judging or hating or saying, why can't you even, you know, why can't you do this or any of that? It's just walking one step after the next. All right, can I be with this? Can I approach this? Sometimes questions are more helpful. Yeah, so that is a really helpful shift in understanding, though.
Thank you. It does feel more manageable now that I think about it in those terms, though still not easy, but more manageable to think of a way forward.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And these, you know, these truths, I know when I first heard the word noble, I thought, this doesn't have anything to do with me. What is this? What could this possibly have to do with me? But in this invitation to enter an ongoing process, some teachers, Christina Feldman, others talk about it as ennobling, right? They're not noble. They don't make you noble because you believe something. It's a process of ennobling. So in that, we actually come back to some kind of deep, we come more fully into ourselves, into our own dignity, into our own skin. It's ennobling. Empowering isn't quite the right word, but we kind of come back into our maybe dignity as human beings, right? Okay. Yeah, Beth, please.
When you were speaking about what your conversation with Rodney about the reasons that people stay or come back, I was in the camp of the curiosity people.
Oh, bless you.
well, not, you know, because I didn't really think that I suffered. Okay. Until I got into this practice. And then I'm like, oh, but that speaks to what you were just saying, the ennobling piece, because I didn't know. That was part of my ignorance. My state of ignorance is not being in touch with all the ways that you suffer. I mean, the list that you were making in the discourse, I'm thinking, what mind moments do we not suffer? When is that not? I mean, it's constant, but to know it is, I'm realizing, not always with happiness, but definitely with more clear seeing, when I know my suffering, it feels like that is an awakening.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, beautiful, beautiful, yeah. When I know my suffering, it is an awakening. That's a wonderful insight, yeah. Yeah. And I think the curiosity, they go together at some point. Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah. Oh my goodness, you're going to have to read it for me. Is it? Please. Yeah, I see.
I'm ready. Yeah.
I'm sorry. You all are getting a front row seat to my my squinting. Okay, please. Yes.
My name's Beth. Is that, am I who you're talking about?
Yes, and then okay. I see Emery too.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But no, please Emery, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, I was just going to say, it seems like everything that you talked about, well, a lot of what you talked about tonight, it seems like psychology, because I've been going through therapy for the last couple of years, and they have this saying, feel it to heal it. And it just seems like they're catching up with this ancient wisdom, that whole thing about the felt sense. And the guy who you mentioned said that you have to have the felt sense. That was my experience too. I did sort of talk therapy for a long time, and I heard someone else describing it as just sort of re-traumatizing. But then when I really started feeling Well, I don't know about the re-traumatizing stuff, but I did, I noticed personally that the therapy sessions when I cried and felt the worst, like the following week and after that, I always felt so much better. It was like really healing. So that's all I was going to share. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, certainly used in therapeutic modalities a lot as well. And the Buddha talked about himself as a healer. He talked about the Four Noble Truths as medicine. So, yeah, sometimes there can be, we could talk a lot about the differences and similarities between therapy and Buddhism, but often for most of us, there's some overlap between those two. Ultimately, we'll talk about clinging next month, right? So we'll talk about clinging to a sense of I and sense of me and all of that. So we'll go a little bit deeper, but yes, that felt sense, which yeah, Buddhists and therapists alike have been plagiarizing for years. So, but to good end, I think. Okay, great. Yeah, Emery, nice to see you.
Hi, Carrie. I just want to thank you so much for this talk. It was so beautiful and so personal, you know, and just such a raw and tender subject. And I too feel a sense of relief to be able to just, I feel like the First Noble Truth is like the greatest gift of like, hey, this is normal. This is part of the human experience. This is, it's like Buddha did everybody such a big favor by saying, yeah, this is part and parcel of the human experience. And it really, I mean, it's hard. It's a hard teaching. It's a hard thing to, you know, kind of really come to grips with and really accept and certainly to feel. But there is also this like beauty in it, this like, this shared experience of how tender we all are and how tender life is. And I just think you really captured it well. And, sometimes it even, I don't know, it almost makes me want to laugh, like almost like a yeehaw, like, yeah, there is suffering and here we all are. And let's just like put it out there, you know,
but that laugh is like relief. You know, sometimes the laugh is like relief, like, oh, I've been kind of warding this off a little bit, mm-hmm. but hey, it's out in the open. Like mm-hmm. I was actually thinking about this on the way over, you know, often in recovery circles, you know, you start by saying, you know, I'm Carrie, I'm an alcoholic or I'm an addict or whatever. You start off by just naming it. So what if I had started tonight? I didn't quite have the guts for it, but what if you just started by saying, I'm Carrie and I suffer? You know? Like, can we all just kind of, hi, oh, thank you, and then we're met, we're joined in that, we don't have to pretend, we don't have to, like, sweat beneath the mask, like Thomas Merton said, you know, it's just out, and Philip Moffat's book, now we can dance with life, right, it's the dancing with life. So I'm with you. I feel that. And that's really feeling like, oh, I'm in a process with this. I'm not in a process in which I have to hold my breath until I'm well, or, you know, like not be alive until I'm all better. But it is a tenderizing, relieving truth. I totally, thank you for mentioning that. Thank you.
There are not many places where we're encouraged to talk about it or to feel it. It's very against our own internal sense of self-preservation, and it's very much against like the cultural norms. I mean, maybe in therapy or in sanghas, those are places where we can say like suffering is part of being, you know, an open-hearted person who, it's just part of being a person.
That's right.
Yeah. So anyway, I just loved your talk. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Very helpful.
I was sitting with the nuns, who I hope you all know about. Nuns have landed in this area and are establishing a vihara in Port Townsend. So look it up, Parayana Vihara. They're doing monthly day-longs. Just so much joy around that. But anyway, Ayananda Bodhi, one of the nuns who was there last Sunday when I was sitting with them, and she said, there's a movement between, you know, we often talk about the gap between the way things are and the way we would like them to be. She said, so this movement between how we would like them to be, how we thought things were going to be, how we would like them to be, how we wish they would be, and how they are, there's a gap. And sometimes it's said, in that gap is our suffering. But she said, in that gap, there's a process in which we move from how we thought it should be to how it actually is. And that's a process. That's this process of moving from what we had really hoped for and how it is. And that process is often one of grieving. Right? So it can be one of grieving, one of being tenderized. It can be relieving. It can be grieving. It can be tenderizing. It can be connecting. But just to say that's not immediate. that's not. Oh, this is much different than I thought. That there's a process in there. So anyway, just. Something about when Emery was talking made me think of that also. So it's relieving, but can also involve some grieving as well. So that's the territory we're in. I want to make sure I leave time for announcements as well. Iris, I'm going to need your help. Okay.
I wanted to add another verb to your list. That it can also be healing.
Yes.
Because if I think for a lot of us, the mental suffering is a pattern from years and years, and it gets all tangled and we get triggered and stuff. But when we really have gone into the experience of it, there's some insight in there. And every now and then you have the opportunity where it all comes up and you go, oh, maybe I don't have to choose that. So there can be a moment of healing, and it's probably going to be there till we die, that this tangle, just because it's pretty tangled.
Maybe
not. But there are those moments of just like a little bit.
That's a
softer.
That's it.
Yeah, there it is. But it, you know, and it's familiar. And there's a little bit of healing. So I just wanted to add that verb to all your others, which were great.
I love that, Suze. Thank you. And I think many of us can feel that. And I think it is important to recognize that when we see it in ourselves, because that gives a lot of, it raises the confidence for the, even little, yeah? We're not all the way there, but to even feel a little bit of that lightening, healing, that's like a balm. That's really, really helpful. Yeah, good. Thanks so much for all of your participation tonight. We appreciate you all. And I hope this gives you things to consider to, I know we're coming to the end of the month, but dukkha is a wonderfully rich theme for a long time. And Joan Sutherland's invitation, I love how she says, if I accept the invitation of this world, I accept that this is part of this world. So for a long time, I had a practice in the morning of just waking up and just saying, I accept. Yeah, I accept. This is part of being human today. I accept. So if that's helpful for you at all. And please, as always, take anything that was useful here. Don't feel like you have to grab it all, but take what's useful and leave the rest. Please, if you can, stay for another few minutes because I've saved the announcements till the end. And